Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Friday, February the 7th. And today we're going to catch up with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. We're going to take a look at this campaign of 2020. Very much underway. They had the Iowa caucuses or caucus last Monday night. It became a real problem for the Democrats. Some would say an embarrassment because they just couldn't run it. I mean, they couldn't come up with the vote count. And it was just very embarrassing. That's all I can say. They're going to be voting in New Hampshire on Tuesday. They had a debate tonight. I caught a little bit of that, and I'll share my thoughts later with Barry. The overall state of the Democrat race, I think we will probably know a lot more in about maybe 3 or 4 days after New Hampshire, because some of these candidates are going to have to drop off. They're just not getting any numbers in the polling data. And then we'll take a look at President Trump, who I think is right now standing on very firm ground, very strong ground for re-election. So let me say Happy New Year to the Prairie editor. Barry, Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you.
Yes, we're closer and closer to the baseball season, and for you and I, that's always Happy New Year.
Indeed.
Yes, it is. Well, we have a lot to get into tonight, Barry. This is one of those shows where I think we're probably going to run out of clock because there's so much to talk about. But let me just begin with Iowa. Why don't we start with Iowa? Because I've never been a big fan of the Iowa caucus. You were telling me off the air that it started in 1972. I remember Jimmy Carter doing well in the Iowa caucus in 1976, but you wrote about this, and you feel in your last post that this is the end of the Iowa caucus. So tell us why you feel that way, Barry.
Well, it's not just my opinion. David Yepsen, who's the senior political writer in Iowa for the Des Moines Register and highly respected, wrote right afterwards that it was over. There will not be another. It's common sense. The Iowa caucus was a sort of a newcomer because it was a caucus, and they were able to get in there the week before or 8 days before New Hampshire. But the fact of the matter is that they've had now, this is two, the Democratic caucus anyway, has run into two cycles of controversy and disaster. In 2016, Bernie Sanders alleged that the party establishment were conspired to give the victory to Hillary Clinton. In response, the party created this new method of reporting using an app that failed. They didn't even test it. They really had no backup. Even now, it's now Friday night, we still don't have 100% of the returns, and what we do have is questionable. And although Buttigieg is claiming some sort of victory because he, in a very arcane way of figuring, he actually had a slight lead. In terms of the actual turnout, Bernie Sanders won not only in the raw turnout, but in the second grouping of turnout where people who were supporting candidates had to go support another candidate came more to him than they came to Buttigieg, and mm-hmm. he actually won both, one by 5,000, one by 2,500 votes. They will get the same amount of delegates, I guess. Mm-hmm. But in any event, it was frustrating to the campaigns, to the media, and most of all to the voters, both local and national,
sure,
wanted to know the result. And I think that having failed twice, especially in such an egregious manner this time, there's virtually no chance at all that they will be back next cycle. And then, to top it off, the national chairman, Mr. Perez, said enough is enough, let's have a recount. And the party chair dismissed him summarily,
yeah,
saying, I won't do it. That's a certain... I mean, I don't know why that,
yeah,
party chair is still there. I mean, if I were in the party, I would have demand the resignation of the entire leadership of the Iowa party.
Yeah,
they did not serve their party well, and it was a very bad start to the cycle. They will go on now into New Hampshire, which is a paper ballot, and we'll get actual,
mm-hmm,
results, and then we'll go on to Nevada and South Carolina, and most importantly on March 11th we will go to Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
And the introduction of Mr. Bloomberg into the campaign, and I have been writing, as you know,
mm-hmm,
Silvio, that all of these events, the latest being the debacle in Iowa, is leading up to a contested convention.
Right.
Which is,
yes,
very bad news for the Democrats, because if they have to fight it out in a convention, and there's clearly two completely polarized sides. If you think the American public is polarized,
right,
the Democratic Party is polarized. And,
absolutely.
I don't know how they put it all together in time for November.
No, I agree with you. But let me go back to Iowa for a second, because I want to get your thoughts on the results. Not the mistakes that were made, not the computer, but I mean, let's assume that these numbers are right, just for the sake of argument. I thought that Bernie Sanders would sort of have a big day, but Mayor Pete Buttigieg had a pretty decent day. Were you surprised by that, Barry?
Well, as I wrote,
yes,
Bernie, who I wrote that Bernie basically won the caucus,
mm-hmm,
narrowly. And that was as expected. The two surprises, there were three surprises. One was Buttigieg doing better than expected, although we knew he was doing well. He was well organized in Iowa, and he had sort of assumed the non Biden moderate role, and Biden was not doing well. His appeal was not, Biden is a blue collar candidate who appeals to black voters, and there's not that many blue-collar and black voters in Iowa. So it wasn't the ideal place for him. And the person who wanted to get the result that Mayor Pete got was Amy Klobuchar from neighboring Minnesota, my own state, and she did not. She came in fifth, and where she had been all along. And she put a massive effort into the campaign with staff, money, and ads, and her own campaigning. Although, she, like the other senators, she was blocked from campaigning in the last,
right,
2 weeks because of the impeachment trial. But the surprise, and that was a little surprise, because I thought Amy would do better,
mm-hmm,
in fifth, and her efforts would pay off, which they did not. So Iowa was not full of big surprises. The media, of course, is making the most of it. And Mayor Pete is also doing well, as is Bernie Sanders in,
mm-hmm,
New Hampshire. And Biden is not doing as well. But his strength lies in the next two states, South Carolina and Nevada. And then, of course, there'll be a big test for all the candidates, including Mike Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
In Super Tuesday, when so many delegates are chosen.
Right.
But the way it's shaping up, Silvio, is that the top seven, there's top seven candidates, top eight, top six. It varies depending on how you look at it. But they're all going to have delegates. And they're all going to have, no one's going to have no one's going to run away with this thing, and have the nomination sewn up before Milwaukee in July. And, of course, if they have a convention that's contested, that's very bad news, because although they will come up with a nominee, of course, they will wake up on the 1st of August with only 3 months to go, with very little money, a divided party, and a triumphant Trump who has survived impeachment. So it's not shaping up. That can change. You know,
sure.
A month ago, Mr. Trump was not in his great shape. He was still in the midst of the impeachment. It didn't necessarily look good. It was very problematic. People were testifying right and left. And so people were saying it wasn't looking good for him. Now suddenly he looks very strong. I think you pointed
right.
out to me in private that the odds makers in Nevada now
right.
think he has a 60% chance of winning.
That's right.
And that's an important measure, because those historically, those odds makers are much more right than the pundits.
Right. Well, they're so, putting their own money. I mean, this is not
yes.
political. You know, these are not pundits. These are people who are betting. That's just an objective thing. You know, they're betting for an election the same way they would bet for the Super Bowl or the World Series or whatever. Now, back to Iowa for a second, because I wanted to ask you another question. I really was not expecting the Vice President Biden to do that well. I thought he would be okay, but the one person who I think I expected better was Elizabeth Warren, and I'm beginning to think that she's in a bit of a decline, that she doesn't have, just like you were talking about your senator from Minnesota, I don't think Elizabeth Warren has a big window here. If she doesn't score some points here pretty soon, I think she's out, Barry.
Well, she has a big test. Like Amy was from neighboring Minnesota, Elizabeth Warren is from the next door state to New Hampshire. And they all know her very well. And she was leading there earlier in the year. She has gone down nationwide, which began with her Medicare for All proposal, which was is not very popular. She has remained sort of defiant about that. She is trying very hard. She's a very ambitious person, and she works very hard. She has a big organization. She has money. So I'm not writing her off, but if she doesn't come in first or second or a very close third in New Hampshire, I think she's in real trouble, because she's not going to necessarily do well in Nevada and South Carolina. And then we get to the big states in Super Tuesday. But now we will have a new factor, and his name is Michael Bloomberg, and he is breaking all records in spending,
mm-hmm.
outspending 10 to 1 or more. Even Tom Steyer, who's spending millions.
Mm-hmm.
Michael is spending hundreds, tens of millions, and over $100 million altogether, just so far, and
right.
it's having some impact. He's registering. He's, I think, third in New Hampshire, and or certainly in some of the Super Tuesday states, third nationally, in some polls. Although
mm-hmm.
we have to take all polls with a grain of salt. As
right,
you
right.
and I both know.
Now, let's talk a little bit about New Hampshire. New Hampshire is on Tuesday. And, you know, New Hampshire, I remember was the big one. I mean, that was the one that sort of got everything going until the Iowa caucus came in. But what, like, you know, not necessarily a prediction, but how do you think New Hampshire is going to turn out? I mean, who has to do well? Does Bernie Sanders have to win New Hampshire to keep the momentum? Is Elizabeth Warren in a difficult situation? Vice President Biden, I think he has to do well. Mayor Pete. How do you see New Hampshire next Tuesday night? What are you expecting?
We have two senators who are from neighboring states. One Bernie Sanders from Vermont, and Elizabeth Warren. And Bernie's been leading in the polls. He essentially won, as I saw it, Iowa, although he didn't get it so confused. He didn't get very much benefit from it. I think he was is expected to win New Hampshire. If he does not, he's still, you know, he and Biden are basically in this close to the end. They even if they're doing poorly in the early primaries, they have a national base. Each has a base that's very, very loyal, and Biden, of course, has a significant support among Black Democrats, and that will. And whereas we approach some states with large Black populations, like Pennsylvania, New York, California, Michigan, Wisconsin, he's going to do better than he's been doing so far. So those three need to do. Warren must do well. She's much more vulnerable than Bernie or Biden. Mayor Pete is coming up to states where he does well in states like Iowa and New Hampshire because there's not a lot of ethnic populations which aren't particularly excited by his candidacy so far. But if he can build some momentum, you never know. He's certainly the fresh face of the 2020 election. And then there's other candidates, but none of them seem to be, except for Mayor Bloomberg, with much hope for going anywhere. Mr. Steyer has been competing and spending a lot of money, but he does not seem to be catching on. He came in the race mainly to promote his issues on the environment. But it's not clear. I don't think we're going to come out of New Hampshire or even South Carolina or Nevada. I don't think we really know anything until Super Tuesday.
Right. And then Super Tuesday is when Mike Bloomberg could just go to the top. Or, I mean, I assume if he doesn't do well on Super Tuesday, that's the end of him, right? Because, I mean, if he spent all that money and he couldn't get anything out of Super Tuesday or just a few delegates, I mean, that's not going to speak well for Mike Bloomberg, Barry.
Right. Well, especially since so many delegates are involved.
Right.
Although New York lies ahead, and he will do well in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't expect Mike Bloomberg to bow out no matter what.
Right. He's got the money to hang on, but... But no matter what, and then I'll ask you this, and then we'll take a break. No matter what happens, even between now and even on Super Tuesday, the delegates, like you were saying before, or you said the last time, the delegates are not they're not winner take all. So you may have 200 delegates, and they're all going to be spread out, which is what makes a broker convention inevitable.
Contested.
I mean, I agree with you. I think we're headed in that direction because I don't see anybody breaking out and having the delegates by the time they get to Milwaukee.
Right.
Barry?
Yeah. I'm in complete agreement with you.
Yeah. So, well, let me do this. Let's take a little break, and then when we come back, I like to talk a little bit about what would happen in a contested convention. I mean, maybe go back to some of the conventions in the past. I think the last one was 1952 on the Democrat side, and that's obviously a long time ago. So let's take a little break, and we'll come back with our friend, the Prairie Editor, right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Just a reminder that the music we just heard and the music on our program is the music of Carlos Geddes, and we have a link to his website. Check him out. Get some of his music if you want to. And if you're in the Dallas area, check out where he's playing. He's always a lot of fun to listen to when you're going out to dinner. Let's get back to our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. Well, Barry, I think the next 30 days are going to be pretty pretty crazy for the Democrats. But I agree with you that they will get to Milwaukee or the convention and have a contested convention. What that means is that nobody wins in the first ballot, basically. That's what that means, right?
Yes.
And we, I remember there was a lot of talk about this in 2016 with President Trump, or when he was a candidate. Remember that? In fact, I think you and I even talked about it a little bit back in 2016. Oh, it was never really serious, as serious as the Democrats this year, because the Republicans have the winner take all. So he was able to wrap it up by May or June just by winning 30% of the vote in some states. Here, that's not going to happen, Barry.
Right.
So they get to Milwaukee. They take the first vote. No one has a majority. And then do they have different rules that come into effect, or do the superdelegates take over? I mean, what?
Well,
I mean,
then they have a dilemma, because you have two sides. So it's going to – anything can happen. I mean, I pointed out in 1924, the Democratic convention went for 103 ballots. And they ended up with a guy who nobody knew about, and he lost in a landslide to Calvin Coolidge. We've had other sort of quote, open conventions. The most famous one, of course, was the 1896 Democratic Convention, in which the nominee wasn't even a candidate until the convention began. And he gave the keynote speech, which electrified the audience, the famous Cross of Gold speech, and William Jennings Bryan became the nominee. He ended up being a nominee two more times, and the only three-time contestant who never won.
Mm-hmm.
But anything can happen. And you could, I mean, there's going to be a lot of, there's a growing pessimism among Democrats, people like James Carville,
yes,
Michael Moore, and others who I don't particularly agree with all the time. But even they are sending out red flags, as it were, saying, Democrats, you're making, you know, this impeachment was a folly. This way you're doing things is not working well.
Mm-hmm.
Iowa was a disaster, and there's getting a feeling of a potential landslide for Trump that could bring down the control of the House. I mean,
yes,
Nancy Pelosi has done herself no favors. I always had a lot of respect. I didn't necessarily agree with her, but I always had a lot of respect for her political acumen. But that's changed.
Mm-hmm.
She seems to be becoming one of these obsessive Trump haters, so filled with her emotions about this that she's behaving in ways that don't make much sense. Now, her tearing up the president's State of the Union speech,
right,
was great fodder for Democrats who were already convinced they're going to vote for Trump. But other than that, it didn't do her any good.
Mm-hmm.
And she's appeared,
yeah,
to other people as being over-emotional, petty, and,
right,
and highly partisan.
No, I agree with you. I was watching it, and I remember, I think it was Bret Baier of Fox News said, did you just see that? I mean, it was like nobody could believe it. But if you remember in the speech that night, speaking of Speaker Pelosi for a second, during the whole speech, she kept making all these faces and always looking at what apparently was her side of the room, I guess, looking at some of the Democrats on her side of the room. And I kept thinking to myself, this is not good for her, because it makes her look, you know, silly. I mean, she's a grown woman. She's a smart woman. She has to know that this is not good for her. But maybe, you know, maybe she is infected with this thing they call Trump derangement syndrome that is driving a lot of Democrats crazy. But let me go back to the point you just made about James Carville and Michael Moore and some of these others. I think it's too late to stop the train. The train's already gone. I mean, this is a party that I think went off the, you know, went on the, or took the left wing track. And I think it's too late to stop them now. I mean, I don't see how you put Bernie Sanders back in the bottle. I mean, if they try to take away the nomination from Bernie Sanders, Milwaukee is going to be an explosion, Barry.
Well, and November will be a very unpleasant surprise for the Democrats. I don't know if it's too late. I've learned, I've been doing this a long time, Silvio, and I learned never to say never. So I'm, and since I write a column that I hope is respected at least by people of both parties, I try and be fair. So I've learned to be, not to, to put a partisan bent on it. You are, by, you know, self-proclaimed and honestly a conservative, and so you, it's much
right,
more
right, right.
legitimate.
No,
for
I,
you to
I
do
agree
that.
With that. I agree.
And
with
I
that.
Understand that. So I, but I must say, as you saw in my last column, I'm sort of getting off the fence here because the Democrats are making so many mistakes. It's starting to look pretty, but there's 8 months to go, and that's still a long time, and the economy still is the number one item, and that's one of the reasons why, as long as it holds up, Mr. Trump is probably going to be unbeatable. You don't know what's going to happen with that. You don't know what's going to happen in the world affairs. We've got this thing in China that's unknowable.
Yes.
And plus we've got all these hot spots in the world, in the Middle East, in South China Sea, in South America, in Europe. The one winning ticket seems to have been our cousins in Great Britain, where Boris Johnson won a landslide victory over a Labour Party that had gone very far left, which is, of course, what Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are trying to do with the Democratic Party in this country. And we see what happens. The public, even the working class voters, the blue-collar voters, the union members, will reject that because they're much more moderate, much more common sense than some of their leaders are. And again, the president was somewhat wounded during the House impeachment process, but if you were going to really damage his reelection, you had to take him out in the Senate, and they never could. They had hopes of doing better, but except for Mitt Romney on one count, it was entirely a party line vote, and I think pretty much an abject failure on the part of the Democrats. And the end. And the president, rightfully, you know, he was very self-disciplined in his State of the Union speech. Didn't even
sure was
do more than a slight allusion to the impeachment. But then the next day, when he wasn't doing his, his constitutional act, when he could let his hair down, he really gave it to him. And you don't blame him.
No.
They have been after him since the night he was elected. They were even talking about impeachment before he took office.
Right.
So.
No, I agree. People were calling for his impeachment in 2017, like you say. In fact, tonight in that presidential debate, when they were talking about impeachment, Tom Steyer said he started impeachment in 2017. And I asked myself, impeachment over what? I mean, what were you going to impeach him on back then? And so these people were so. I think they're a little bit crazy. I really do, and I know that's a partisan way to put it, but I just think they're not behaving very logically. I mean, for example, during the State of the Union, to have all these women dressed in white, I don't know. I think that looks kind of silly to me, Barry. And I'm a Republican. I get that, but I would say the same thing of a bunch of Republican women dressed in whatever color. They say they're dressed in red. I just think that's silly. That's like high school stuff, and I have to think most Americans see that.
Well, it's meant to have a psychological effect via the media, and I think they're miscalculating. I don't think they understand the public psychology. They understand the psychology of their own base, which, of course, is pushing for all this stuff. They want melodrama. They want soap opera hysterics. They love that. They loved her base. Loved Nancy Pelosi tearing up the speech.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the choir that's already been preached to. Those votes are already in the bag. What they got to do is that 10 to 15% of votes, which are open. I think each party has 40 to 42% of the vote nailed down right now. And it's about 10 to 15% of people who will make the decision in November. And those are the people you want to reach. And those people one of the reasons they haven't made up their minds is they still have a lot of common sense and still, you know, open-mindedness. And you're certainly not going to win them over with hysterics and melodrama.
Right.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
And I'll tell you something else.
Yeah,
the president is doing something very, very interesting. As others have pointed out, that State of the Union speech was directed in many ways to a black America.
Yes, absolutely.
And for me, the high point, for me, and it's personal, that Tuskegee Airman, 103
yes.
years old, who he promoted to Brigadier General, that moment was as good as it gets. Now, it was slightly emotional, and it's my take, but because I've always been a very pro-civil rights guy, and I've always felt we've had to do things to recognize our black fellow citizens in ways that we have not done in the past. And so that was a great moment. And there were many others, some of them a little. They were all sort of self-serving, I agree. But every president since Clinton has been doing this, since Reagan, has been using this State of the Union to have visitors in the gallery who illustrate a point that they have. So it's nothing new. President
right.
Trump did a little more of it than anyone else, and he did it better than anyone
right.
else.
No, I thought that was brilliant. No, I thought the speech was, as you say, you know, the term, very disciplined. He stuck to the script. No, you know, no side remarks or side, you know, side jokes or you know, attacks at anybody. He just stuck to the plan. And I think you're right. I think the presentations of the individuals. I mean, one by one, every person who was presented had a topic, if you will, or an idea. And I thought presenting the president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, I thought that was brilliant because one of the groups, one of the states, of course, that he has to win is Florida. And
yes.
Florida is obviously, there's a growing Venezuelan population there as well as there's a Cuban population. And if he's running against Bernie Sanders, I think Venezuela is going to be a big topic, Barry.
Right. Well, Bernie Sanders is going to be lucky to win 10 states if he's the nominee. But
yeah.
That's just
well, let me give you another scenario for the Democrats before we get to President Trump. They go to a broker convention or a contested convention. What is the difference between brokered and contested? I hear both. Which one is more
well,
correct?
Well, a contested convention is a convention in which the nominee has not been determined, and the delegates to the convention makes a determination. A brokered convention is same situation, but in which party power figures.
Okay.
Behind the scenes, make wheel and deal and broker the convention.
The way it used to be in the 19th century, let's say.
Yes.
And for some, but in this case, though, it would be contested because it will be the delegates on the floor that will
drive
it.
Right. There's very few power brokers. Now, what could broker the convention would be someone like Michael Bloomberg coming into the convention with a very large number, but impossible to be nominated. And then he says, well, if you want, I'll pick the nominee, and I'll have my delegates go to him or her. That would be a brokered convention.
Mm-hmm.
So there's
okay.
still the possibility of a brokered convention, but the brokerage would be other candidates who couldn't win the nomination, but who have themselves large numbers of votes. Elizabeth Warren could be in that position.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Biden himself, if he falls short, could be. So you could have a brokered convention, but especially if there's no rule that anyone who's been in the
mm-hmm.
race so far is going to be the nominee. So you could have somebody who hasn't even run be
right.
the nominee in a contested convention.
Right, because they could just rally around. Isn't that sort of what happened with Eisenhower in 52?
No. Eisenhower pretty much had it locked up.
Oh, okay. Okay.
He was opposed by Taft, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't recall whether there was more than a couple of ballots.
Right.
But
on the Democrat side in 52, that's how they got Stevenson, right?
Well, what happened was Truman came out for Stevenson.
Oh, okay.
So that was essentially a brokered convention in many ways, because
yeah.
Truman, who was the incumbent president, threw his support behind Stevenson.
Yeah. Truman decided not to run, I guess, or...
Right. Well,
he realized
he couldn't win.
He couldn't win. Yeah, sort of like LBJ in 1968. But here's another scenario that I want to get your reaction to before we talk about President Trump. They get to the contested convention, and Bernie Sanders, they sort of push him aside. They force him aside and he's not a factor. But Bernie Sanders has very, very devoted followers. In fact, I would think he has the best following of them all, certainly the most devoted followers. And these followers decide to say, what? You know, we want you to run as an independent.
Well, I think they're past most of the deadlines. So it would be very difficult to be in most states. But he could run as in several states. Plus, he could run as a write-in candidate,
mm-hmm.
and he certainly would end. It would make the race would be over,
mm-hmm.
because he would get millions of votes, no question about it. And
well, he could flip some blue states, to Trump. That was my point.
Yeah,
absolutely, he could,
no question about
it. He could take a state like, let's say, even Vermont,
or Minnesota.
Minnesota, yeah, well, that would be the case, yeah, Minnesota. And he could flip even some of the coastal states. Maryland, for example, that could happen too. Because, I mean, Trump is going to get, in some of these blue states, Trump is going to get anywhere from 40 to 45% of the vote. So, the other 55 would be divided between, let's say, a Sanders faction and whoever the Democrat is. So conceivably, you could have Trump winning many of these blue states on the plurality and, getting 450 electoral votes, Barry.
Right. Well, unless things change substantially, it's not looking good for the Democrats right now. But, again, things can change substantially.
Look how they've changed in a few months the other way. Well, let's do this. Let me take a little break, and then when we come back, I want to talk about President Trump and who – all of a sudden looks pretty strong for re-election. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. We're going the whole clock tonight with our friend Barry Kosselman, the Prairie editor. There's so much to talk about, and I wanted to make sure that we gave Barry the whole hour so we could talk about lots of these things. So let's get back to our friend Barry. Barry, I want to begin with President Trump because the very latest betting out of Vegas, and these are just betting people. These are not political people. They're giving him a 60% chance of reelection. Now, I don't personally know any of these people who are betting like this, but I think if we had him on the show tonight and we would ask him, why are you betting that President Trump is going to be reelected? I think he would say two things, or the betting person would say two things. Number one, the economy, and number two, the state of the Democrat Party. Would you agree with that, with what I've just said?
Yes. Now, you understand these betting odds can change a lot. For example, for about two solid months, Elizabeth Warren was the overwhelming betting favorite to be the Democratic nominee over Biden and Sanders. And that has been completed. Now she's down to third or fourth. So that those betting odds things are as changeable as anything else, as polls are. I mean, the bets are permanent, and it's the odds you get when you place your bet that counts in terms of what your return is. But as you point out, these are not political people; these are people who are
right,
hoping to make money, so they're using common sense standards. They're not infected with Trump hatred or Trump love.
Right, right, exactly.
You're exactly right.
I mean, these are,
but,
go ahead.
But, as you know, I mean, I think things have changed. I think Trump has survived. There was one threat after another to Trump's presidency, beginning even before election, before they sworn in. You know, they tried to get the electors and the Electoral College to switch their vote. I mean, there was so much negative reaction, really unprecedented in American history, I think in modern history anyway. But he has survived it all. And now his numbers are the highest they've been, not only in the Rasmussen poll, which has been his best numbers, but even in Gallup, is actually stronger than Rasmussen. And the IBD, the International Business Daily polls, and even NBC. So a lot of the polls which have shown him in the low 40s now show him in the high 40s, and a couple of them show him popularity. So he is in a strong position. He doesn't. One of his opponents, minor Republican opponents, I think it was Mr. Walsh, bowed out today.
Mm-hmm.
So now he has only even one technical opponent for the nomination, and that's going nowhere. He doesn't have to spend a dime. He's got quite a bit of money in the bank already. And he can just sit by while the Democrats eat each other up, which is what they seem to be doing. And they allowed, as I wrote about it extensively, they allowed this impeachment process to get in the way of public interest in the election, and insofar as it had two of the major candidates, and four senators couldn't even campaign for Iowa and New Hampshire because they had to sit in the Senate for the impeachment hearing, so impeachment trial. What we had here was a diversion created by the Democrats and the House Democrats, and they've allowed their party to be divided into two essential factions, one liberal left center, and the other left, more progressive far left, and the two are instead of coming together, they're getting angrier and angrier at each other and threatening each other. And I don't know how this ends up. I mean, yeah. People always ask me, well, make a prediction. Who's going to be the Democrat nominee? And I said, you know, the honest answer is I have no idea.
Right.
I mean, I
yeah,
have a little
nobody
idea.
Does.
I have a little no. idea, but I wouldn't make any prediction because so many things can happen. And we really don't know until we get to Super Tuesday what even the contours of the race are going to be
right.
leading up to July and the convention in Milwaukee.
Well, there's so much time, though. Yeah,
what?
Let me just jump in for a second. There's so much. I mean, if you think about it, there's so much time. California is on Super Tuesday, right? So
yes.
let's assume that Super Tuesday happens, and you know, let's assume that you know, let's even Michael Bloomberg. Let's say he's got a decent day. He picks up a few delegates, and let's say that three or four come out of Super Tuesday with delegates. They still have four more months of campaigning. And so they have a lot more primaries coming up. They have a lot more months to basically argue with each other. I cannot believe that Michael Bloomberg would be a very popular figure at this party's convention in 2020. I think they would see Michael Bloomberg as just another crazy billionaire with a lot of money who's trying to buy the nomination, Barry.
Well, you could look at it that way. Actually, there's only 3 months after Super Tuesday. There's slightly less than 3 months of primary caucus campaigning left. Then there's a 1 month, 1.5 month period between the last primary in June and the convention, where, of course, delegates can be sought after. And there will be uncommitted delegates. And, of course, we still have the superdelegates who, instead of being able to vote on the first ballot, will be able only be able to vote on the second ballot. But if we're going to have a contested convention, that's meaningless. So then the superdelegates become very important again.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the party establishment, which seems, I mean, President Obama is reportedly in a stop Bernie mode, as is Hillary Clinton, as is a number of other party establishment figures. Who do they stop Bernie with?
Mm-hmm.
It's probably Joe Biden. But if Joe Biden doesn't do well in the primaries, then they have a problem. I mean, it just doesn't. You know, when we gather, you and I, and on this program again, presumably after Super Tuesday, and then again over the summer months, things can change. I agree, and we have to concede that things are very volatile this year. But
right
now, it's not looking too good. Mainly, primarily, not because the Republicans are so fantastically well organized and whatever, but because the Democrats have been making one political mistake after another.
Mm-hmm.
They're now, the authors of their own problems.
That's
and
right.
I've been writing about this for months. And in fact, some of my conservative readers send me notes saying, stop giving good advice to the Democrats.
That's right.
And I write back, I say, it doesn't make any difference because no
right.
one's going to
no.
take my advice, good or bad. And the fact is that but I can't help but observe when you do something, when you tear up the State of the Union speech after the speech is obviously very successfully made, you do that on the camera, you take a chance. When you push for an impeachment quickly and then you don't even submit it to the Senate for a month, and then when you do, you don't have the votes. I mean, so what that was all about, frankly,
right.
was not to remove him, but to expose him.
Right.
But the
but
problem
it backfired.
Is, it backfired because there's no, as far as some people will disagree with me, and I respect that, but I don't see what the case is.
Right. I agree. I'm with you, which is why I'm so disappointed with Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
I've always been a huge fan of Mitt Romney. You know this. I love Mitt Romney. I supported him in 2012. Was very disappointed that he didn't win, but I'm very disappointed that Mitt Romney did what he did. Two more quick questions I want to ask you about about 2020 and what could happen from all of this. Well, the first one is not a question. I just wanted to read, and maybe you saw this article by Peggy Noonan, where she said, quote, "The fiasco in Iowa, the foolishness at the State of the Union, do they realize how bad they look?" And that's the point you're just making. You know, tearing up the speech like that, I mean, they look silly to, I think, a lot of people. But the second question is something of real interest to me is the House of Representatives and the potential for a switch. A few months ago, it didn't look good, and you wrote about it. We talked about it. I have to think that it looks a little bit better now, if for no other reason that many of these Democrats are going to go home, and when they have to explain to people what they did, they haven't done anything, Barry.
Well, it's true. I think you're absolutely right. In Minnesota, we had one of the two Democrats who voted not to impeach, but even he, even having done that, is still probably going to lose his seat in the Minnesota 7th District. Now we have a contest in the Minnesota 2nd District where we have a very couple of one particular dynamic Republican who's going to go after the incumbent Angie Craig, the Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a chance of at least two, maybe even three pickups in Minnesota of Republican seats. And that's Minnesota, of all places.
Mm-hmm.
You have 31 seats won by Democrats in 2018 in districts in which Trump had won and which there was very little Trump turnout. And now the Trump voters, as we agreed at the outset of the program, are really aroused and are going to turn out. So they're not necessarily going to vote for Democrats for the Congress. And the chairman of the Republican effort is Tom Emmer, who's a Minnesota congressman.
Mm-hmm.
And I attended an event that he spoke at. It was off the record. But I can simply say, as you can imagine, he's optimistic about
mm-hmm.
his party's prospects. He would be in any event. But I think he can make a good case for a strong Republican effort in the House and also in the Senate. You know, they talk about the vulnerable Democrats. I've been fortunate enough that many of them have come up to Minnesota for fundraisers, so I've had a chance
mm-hmm.
to interview them and spend some time with them. And I'm not so sure the Democrats, I mean, I think Arizona and Colorado are somewhat vulnerable. I don't think Maine is really that vulnerable. I think Susan Collins is going to win. Tom Tillis will win in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
But we know for a fact that, not for a fact, but very likely that the Republicans are going to take back the Alabama seat, especially now
mm-hmm.
Doug Jones voted to convict. And then in Michigan, we have a very charismatic Republican candidate, John James, a black West Point graduate. He was here. I was very impressed. Some people
mm-hmm.
say he's eventually a presidential candidate.
Yeah,
that's getting ahead
yeah.
of the game.
No, but I think he is that impressive. I agree with you.
And he's running against a relatively unknown incumbent Democrat, Gary
mm-hmm.
Peters in Michigan. So you could pick up, you could see at least a pickup of two, maybe even three or four Democratic seats. So they're going to probably keep the majority in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
You know, and of course, you know what's been going on. Mitch McConnell, who's making himself an historic
yes.
majority leader
with those judges,
addition,
yeah.
Now that under his belt, he's not only gotten all these judges in, but he brilliantly ushered the impeachment trial to a conclusion.
Right. No, he's doing a fantastic job. I agree with you.
I think he's going down in history as one of the most effective majority leaders of all time.
I agree.
And he's got yeah. he and the president necessarily aren't pals, but they're working together. And
well, they're getting things done. I mean, they're getting things done, which is frankly all that matters. I mean, they don't have to love each other, but they're getting things done. And Mitch McConnell, I agree with you, has been absolutely fantastic. Well, let's do this. Let's touch base after Super Tuesday and see how everything looks. But I think tonight I'll just close by saying that I think President Trump is in a pretty strong position. If the election were held tomorrow, I think he'd be in a pretty strong position. But I agree with you. There's 8 months left, and a lot of things can go wrong, and 8 months is a lifetime. But like always, I want to thank you for your time. This hour has flown. The hour has just flown. But I want to thank you so much for your time and for the wonderful stuff that you do with the Prairie Editor. And let's make a date after Super Tuesday, Barry.
Well, it's always my pleasure to chat with you and your listeners. And I look forward to our next conversation.
We'll certainly do it. We'll do it by right after Super Tuesday. We'll plan to do it then and take stock of where everything is. Good night, Barry.
Good night.
All right. Our good friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor, we have a link to the Prairie Editor website on the show information. Click on that, and it'll take you to his website, and you'll learn about what he does. He does some wonderful work, absolutely wonderful political work, and I love it a great deal. I even gave my sons a subscription to the Prairie Editor because I think the work is so good. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.